Welcome back. I just think listening to the news of the world has finally gone insane if we're dealing with anti-mask activists. Just think about that for a second. I don't know what this show would have done over the years without my pal William Hazelgrove. He was on this show talking, and I don't even remember the years, Wright Brothers, wrong story about the Wright Brothers, Shots Fired in Terminal 2, a very personal tale, Madam President, the secret presidency of Edith Wilson that he was on the show. I wrote about it for the paper. Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt. That was on the show. Al Capone in the 1933 World's Fair. He is not only prolific, he is also really, really good. And he always enlightens me. Bill, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Seriously, I don't know what this show would do without you. I mean, you've been on the show virtually for every book because I picked it up and said, my God, another William Hazelgrove book, and started reading it and said, oh, my God, this is fantastic. The latest, Henry Knox's Noble Train. I'd never heard, I certainly had never heard of Henry Knox before, and you make him as vivid a character as I have read about in some time. How did you come upon him?
I was reading David McCullough's 1776, a fantastic book.
He's a good writer, McCullough.
Great writer. And so he covered Knox in about 3 pages.
Uh-huh.
You know, he said this bookseller went off and dragged 60 tons of cannon back to George Washington and basically saved the American Revolution at that point. And then he moved on. And I thought, who is this guy? And so I tried to see, had anybody written a book on him? And all I found was some kids' books. So to me, when you start to dig into what this guy did, it's amazing that he hasn't been covered. And given as much, you know, credit at least to some of the founding fathers.
Well, not only was he a great hero of the Revolution, he's also an unbelievably fascinating guy on his own.
And
his relationship with George Washington is this paternalistic. We'll get into all this. I want to write here. You start to describe Henry Knox, and it's a wonderful beginning of chapter 4, The Rebel Bookseller. Henry Knox, in a white ruffled shirt and vest, stood behind the high desk in his bookstore and looked anxiously for his wife, Lucy. And then I'm skipping a bit here. The London bookstore had become a literary salon in Boston for the fashionable crowd of officers and Tories. It was on April 22nd, 1771, that Knox had just turned 21 when the publishers Eads and Gills posted an announcement in the Boston Gazette. This is what that announcement said, ladies and gentlemen. This day is opened a new London bookstore by Henry Knox opposite Williams Court in Cornhill, Boston, who has just imported in the last ships from London a large and very elegant assortment of the most modern books in all branches of literature, arts, and sciences, and to be sold as cheap as can be bought at any place in town. That is just a remarkable sentence. How did this youngster come to that point in his life?
Well, you know, classic rags to riches story, Horatio Alger. His father runs off when he's 9. He becomes the breadwinner, right?
So
he goes to work for these two booksellers, and basically he's self-educated.
Mm-hmm.
He reads everything, especially military books. And so then, you know, he wants to go get his own bookstore. And that's the part you're reading is when he opens his own store. And this might be interesting to your listeners. He was the first guy to use blurbs. Nobody else had done this, and they were sort of appalled. And then he priced his books low enough where somebody who was considered poor could also buy his books. So you know, and again, people generally thought the books were for more of the upper class. So Henry Knox was really going his own way at a very early age.
When he was drawn, he seems at one point in the book, and, you know, one of the nice things about this book, William Hazelgrove, is the chapters are so short and punchy. I mean, this book really, really moves. So at one point you have, he seemed an unlikely hero. Can I put it that way?
Absolutely. He's a big guy. We might call him heavy set or fat. You know, he's very gregarious. He blew his fingers off in a hunting accident, so he always wears his scarf around it. He's only 25 in 1775, and yet he has you know, managed to create this bookstore. It's successful. As you said, it's sort of attended by the British and the rebels.
Yeah.
He slowly gets radicalized, and then, of course, he stumbles onto the Boston Massacre one night, and this sort of completes him, and it makes him realize this separation will have to occur between America and Britain. And there's no turning back at that point.
Well, I mean, then in like the blink of a historical eye, he's regularly dining with George Washington and various generals. And
right.
and then you write here, too, and you write, you say it, too. Amazingly, comma, Knox was to become a colonel in the artillery corps without ever serving in the army. This was a testament to George Washington's ability to see hidden talent. But it also shows how adept Henry now was at ingratiating himself to those who could show him favor. That's an amazing line. Talk to me about Washington. This book was filled with some, to my mind, interesting revelations about Washington. Maybe not a revelation, but something I'd forgotten, is that Washington had no kids.
Oh, yeah, right. He had no kids. He'd basically been living off his wife's money for 15 years when they tapped him. And just so your listeners know, we're talking now 1775. The British are holed up in Boston.
Yep.
The Americans are surrounding them. And so, you know, Washington comes to lay siege to Boston to try and get the British out. He has no idea how to do it. In fact, he's done pretty badly in the military so far.
I know. But Henry Knox comes to the most unlikely rescue. How difficult, Bill, was it, you know, when you're researching someone who has not been the subject of a lot of previous books, where'd you go? Where'd you find out about this guy?
It was difficult.
Yeah,
he left behind this very dog-eared diary that was just literally he would write it on the fly in the middle of the Berkshire Mountains or, you know, crossing the Hudson. And so I had that. Then I had two military guys, one guy who wrote a little self-published pamphlet, a retired colonel in the 1970s, and then another guy who wrote a study for the Department of Defense in about 2010. And now between all that, you have the papers of Henry Knox, and then you have some secondary accounts. But basically, you have to sort of draw a line through the forest because
yeah.
there's a lot of contradictions about how he did this feat of dragging these cannons, not to blow the story, but 300
yeah.
miles that weigh 60 tons, 120,000 pounds, or 28 SUVs loaded.
Yeah. Oh, and you're not blowing the story. I want people after we take a commercial break to hear the details of that story, because it is one of the it's an amazing adventure tale. It is
yeah.
an amazing adventure tale. So let's take a short break again. Bill's got a great website. It's William Hazelgrove, HAZELGROVE.com. And I can frankly recommend any if you say, oh, I like Teddy Roosevelt, then get his Teddy Roosevelt book. The one that was a real revelation to me, and I've read, you know, the funny thing is, since you've written this, Jim, Madam President, The Secret Presidency of Edith Wilson, I've that book must be the source for a lot of other writers who are writing about that man's presidency, because I've seen that book referenced plenty in recent years. We'll be back momentarily with William Hazelgrove. Welcome back. Undoubtedly, many, 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 many thousands of you listeners or thousands of Americans have heard of Fort Knox. That is basically the only way in which Henry Knox got a bit of immortality, and I dare say that very few people who have heard the word Fort Knox have said, God, I wonder who that's named for. William Hazelgrove will tell you in his new book, Henry Knox's Noble Train, the story of a Boston bookseller's heroic expedition that saved the American Revolution. The expedition itself is more than heroic. It's almost,
yeah.
Bill, it's almost surreal. Washington's proving himself not the world's greatest general. Boston's totally under siege by the British. And so your Henry Knox decides, he doesn't decide, but he is charged with going up almost to Canada to get some armaments.
Right, right, right. Yeah, basically Fort Ticonderoga.
Yeah.
Ethan Allen had taken it with Benedict Arnold. They find out there's all these cannons there, but they're like, you know, we can't get it. It's 300 miles to Boston. Only a fool would attempt this. Well, the fool is Henry Knox, who says, I'll go get it. I'll go get it. Because guess what? You can't lay siege to a city without artillery. And Washington knows this.
Yeah.
And he knows Henry Knox is the guy to do it. So, yes, he takes off on November 17th. With no real idea how to do this. Now, again,
and it's bad weather. I mean, it's horrible weather, too.
Horrible. It's the middle of winter. It's 1775, which is a terrible winter. He's heading up there 300 miles and with no real idea how to do it, except he has this vague idea he's going to use cattle, or rather oxen, sleds, and pull them back. And, you know, Washington's War Council is like, this is ridiculous. But Knox takes off, goes all the way up to Fort George, goes all the way up to Fort Ticonderoga, gets there, loads these things on boats, then goes back across a frozen Lake George, just a little narrow, and I call it, in that chapter, it's called the Hell of Lake George, because
yeah,
it's just, they are, you know, the boats are sinking and everything. But now he's facing the Hudson River, which he has to cross four times, and the Hudson is in various states of thawing and freezing. And Knox doesn't even know if these 5,000-pound cannons will go through the river or not.
I hate to keep laughing, but you do, it is on the surface surreal, but you do tell it in a wonderfully compelling way. I mean, you really do make it an adventure story.
Well, you know, and here's the thing. From the wilderness, he writes Washington a letter and says, I'm on the way with your noble train of artillery. So now, Knox is a religious man. He believes America is ordained by God, okay? And that his quest, by proxy, is also ordained by God. So he elevates this, right? And,
yeah,
and, you know, because this is the pivotal moment. If Washington doesn't get some artillery, General Howe will come out of Boston and just smash him.
Right.
Because his army's just a rat. That's
another, Howe is a very, I didn't know much about him, and you paint a really interesting portrait of this guy, too, General Howe.
Right, for your listeners,
yeah,
the British don't fight in the winter. They go and they party, basically. They go to the theater, they have dinner, Howe has his concubine.
Mm-hmm.
So they say to Howe, listen, you know, there's a place called Dorchester Heights, these cliffs overlooking Boston. I think, you know, we should take this, because if the Americans put cannons up there, we could be in trouble. Howe's like, don't worry about it. If they take it, we'll just take it back.
Yeah.
So there's the setup, right?
Uh-huh.
And so now Knox has to get through the Dorchester, or rather the Berkshire Mountains.
Right.
Which are seemingly impossible.
Yeah, this is like Hannibal, you know, this is like Hannibal's march. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It becomes this quest. And so it all breaks down way up in the top of the Berkshires. The you know, the Teamsters won't go on, the oxen won't go on, the sleds won't go on. And so Knox has to give a speech. And he says to him, this is for the unborn millions to come.
Jeez.
This is not just for us. This is for the unborn millions. And he gets them moving again. You know.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
When you're learning about this guy and you're learning things like that, you must say to yourself, Jesus, how could no one have written about this guy before? Because every one of, you know, through, and I want to get to the epilogue and what happens in his later life, because that's pretty interesting, too, is you must have been befuddled that no one before you had really decided this man's life was worth and his story was worth telling.
Yeah, I am. I mean, you know, every book I write is a corner of history. And I'm like, why didn't somebody say Edith Wilson was the first woman president?
Exactly.
Which, by the way, Trevor White of The Post is now developing into a movie.
Yeah.
Well, it's because nobody came out and just said, yeah, she was the first woman president. Well, why wasn't Henry Knox ever covered as this person who basically saved the American Revolution in 1775?
Yeah. I want to get to read a couple things from the epilogue, too, after this was all over. To the right of George Washington was Henry Knox, who was with him in every battle of the American Revolution from Boston to Yorktown. They were not only brothers in arms, but they became fast friends. Washington had no children, and there was a paternal quality to their friendship. Lucy, who was the wife of Henry, Lucy even stayed at Mount Vernon during one of her pregnancies. When Washington took his leave at the end of the war and said goodbye to Knox, quote, he wept openly as he wrapped his arms around Henry and embraced him, kissing him. on the cheek. Then Knox went on to do not only lend his name to Fort Knox, but here you write, in 1778, he set up a military academy to train officers in strategy, tactics, logistics, and engineering. The school eventually would become West Point. An astonishing character. I would be flabbergasted if movie, except, you know, who knows what the movie business is right. like these days, but this guy is one of the most interesting characters. And, you look at the phenomenon that is Hamilton, and which drew a lot of people back to say, well, who was Aaron Burr again? What did he do? And who was blah, 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 blah. This guy fits. He doesn't fit up there, quite up there with Hamilton, but he's at least as interesting as some of the characters in that play.
Oh, yeah. No, he's a fascinating character. And this really was, I believe after studying history, everybody has this mission. These men, Wilbur Wright, Teddy Roosevelt, everybody has this sort of mission, their raison d'etre, right? So this was Henry Knox's. This was his crossing of the Delaware. I mean, his later life was not great after he left government.
Right.
He didn't do well in business and all this and that, and he fell on hard times. But at this moment in time, this was what he was meant to do. And when he brought those cannons back to George Washington, he put them up on Dorchester Heights, which overlooked Boston, lob those shells onto the British. The British evacuate Boston, giving the Americans their...
It's the first major victory, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's all about that kind of seizing the moment when opportunity... This guy, when you read about him, he was an ambitious young man and an innovative kind of young man, but he certainly did not seem set up for this kind of... I'm glad you brought him to the forefront, Bill. I hope this book does really well, because it's typically written with flair, your typical flair, but it really is a story that needs to be told. And David McCullough was too busy to devote more than 3 pages to it, but you found those 3 pages. What are you working on now? Not to tip off too much, but
No. Well, actually, Rick, you're gonna have to have me back on the show because Sally Rand, American Sex Symbol, is due out in November.
No, really?
Yeah.
She's one of my favorite characters of all time. I'll tell you this: when my father and I were writing a book called Yesterday Chicago, my father hit up many of his old newspaper photographer friends, and one of the highlight pictures of that book is Sally Rand standing behind a piece of frosted glass, and the photographer told the story, it was never printed anywhere else, told the story of being sent up to interview Sally Rand with a reporter, and when the reporter left, Sally Rand said, "Would you like to see me naked?" And the photographer said, "Yes, I certainly would." And she went behind a piece of frosted glass, and so it is I'll make a copy of it and send it to you. And it's a photo of Sally Rand. But Sally Rand was a sensation. She danced into her 70s, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. Yeah. She did. And her feathers are in the deep freeze, because I did all the research at Chicago History Museum, because that's where her papers are, as you probably know.
I know.
Well, her feathers are down there in that deep freeze. Right?
Yeah.
And the fans, so I went down and the curator took me down to see them. And next to it, where it's a pair of spectacles, and he goes, "You know what those are?" And then he goes, "That's Leopold
Love." Yep. Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. William Hazelgrove, it's an honor. I'll see you. We'll talk in November. Maybe you'll be allowed to come in the studio. No guests in the studio. And maybe the world will be an easier, safer, healthier place by then. It's a terrific book, William Hazelgrove's latest. That's his website, williamhazelgrove.com. The book, Henry Knox's Noble Train, the story of a Boston bookseller's heroic, and I would even put in there, it wouldn't fit on the cover, unlikely expedition that saved the American Revolution. Bill, it's always great to talk to you, and always great to read you.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, Rick.
Anytime. See you in November.